Hello everyone, this is Anton Musgrave from Future World, joining you again in the second episode of our podcast series, Fast Forward, powered by Future World. Today it's all about the Cassandra Complex and the Ptolemaic Pivot. We are joined by a wonderful South African, a wonderful executive, Mr. Themba Mkhwanazi, a prominent South African mining executive who's held a number of very senior roles at companies, global organizations like Anglo American. He was the regional director for Africa and Australia. He was CEO of Bulk Commodities, CEO of Kumba Iron Ore, a significant business in the mining industry, and also CEO for Anglo American's thermal coal business. He's been instrumental, folks, in optimizing performance, ensuring responsible operations, guiding strategy across continents. In fact, he's held a position that most of us can only dream of. When I asked around for some sort of insights into Themba, just to introduce him on a more personal note, the sort of typical feedback I was getting is that he's highly engaged. He develops a collaborative environment. He sets clear goals. He's tough. He holds people accountable. But, and this is wonderful, he fosters trust. He's known for mentoring junior smart people. His management style is all about optimism. It's about direct engagement, an enormous ability to listen, skilled mediation traits, and he's built extreme loyalty and amazing team performance over the years. He recently resigned from Anglo American in June 2025, and I have reliably learnt that his next venture will be even more exciting, if you like. And we'll keep that for a subsequent episode, Themba. We won't spill the beans on that at this stage. Themba, welcome to the podcast, and we're really looking forward to your contribution and your insights from this illustrious corporate career in one of the most important industries, perhaps even on the planet.
You're very kind. You're very kind, Anton. I think for me, this podcast series is focused on something that we would call executive intelligence. And obviously, you know, there are three elements to this as we define it. And this also came through work that we did in collaboration with Spencer Stewart, you know, which really says that, you know, the first element is your mental processing ability. And this is more than just intellect. It's more than just, you know, your intelligence, you know, it's how you think, right? And then the second element is application, because it's all great if, you know, you have a high, you know, MPA, but you're not able to turn theory, thoughts, you know, into actual, you know, valuable, tangible outcomes. Yes. And then the third element, you know, is very much your interpersonal skills, you know, or and how you relate with people. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, in order for us to achieve what we achieve through people. So obviously, this is very much in that space of, I would argue, mental processing, you know, ability.
I did introduce you to the Cassandra Complex earlier on. And so give us your perspective of this phenomenon, if you like. Perhaps before you do that, I can just remind our listeners that this was all about a really interesting story that goes way back in history to Cassandra. Cassandra was, in fact, the daughter of Priam, the king of Troy. And she was gifted the gift of prophecy by Apollo. However, he said to her that not only will I give you the gift of prophecy, but we need to balance it out. So I'm going to also give you a curse, sadly, that no one would believe your insights. And so Cassandra, folks, way back in history, foresaw the fall of Troy, but could not prevent the disaster because no one around her would believe her. Now, Themba, in your experience, in your rich corporate background, I mean, there must have been many moments when you had a vision, you had an insight, you had an inkling maybe even of what the future foretold, but those around you in those conservative boardrooms that were risk-averse simply didn't believe the story. Tell us one or two of your experiences.
The Cassandra complex is an important one, you know, because of the field that I am in and I have been in over the last 31 years or so, you tend to find that there's a certain archetype of individual, you know, within that field. And this is what I would call, you know, the technocrat, right? And wired very, very differently, you know, because it is about evidence-based facts. You know, it's about conservativeness and comfort, right? And it is about prognosis, you know, it's about insights and assessments and everything else, you know, before we move, right? Now, every so often, there are those who may have that background and studied in the technical or engineering field that tend to be artists like myself, who obviously think very differently. In fact, I tell a story. I was very good at art. I came to the realization that all artists only start to make money when they are dead. So I should
probably
rather
immediately.
like Van Gogh. So I should probably rather end up going to, you know, the sciences or engineering, and then maybe then I can live my art. But I've found that, you know, I've been able to express my inclination of being an artist, you know, through my work as well, and the privileges that I've had. And I've got to say that, you know, when I think about the Cassandra complex, it starts off with me as a person and how I think and how I manage myself, particularly in light of me seeing things before others can see them. Because what I've tended to realize is that I tend to see things before they happen, and I tend to have the ability to be able to connect the dots around, well, if this is what's going to happen in the future, then this is how we need to prepare ourselves right now. And I think part of this is because of my bent around being extremely conceptual in how I think. I'm a person who thinks in ecosystems, you know, because I believe everything is connected. And it's important for me to really get an understanding of, okay, what part of the ecosystem is this issue or is this opportunity? And how are these things connected? What are the interdependencies, you know, in relation to that? And how should I be thinking about this in terms of the various paradigms? You know, they could be a political paradigm, they could be a social paradigm, they could be a technical paradigm, they could be a commercial paradigm.
These paradigms are all interrelated, they're all interconnected, you know. I actually heard someone say to me on the weekend that because of the interconnectedness of the entire world and all of the ecosystems,
yeah,
the concept of murder is actually equal to suicide, because by murdering someone else, you're actually killing a part of yourself, because we are all interconnected, which was an interesting concept. But I love the fact, Tembo, that you were an artist and can think conceptually. Obviously, you have an incredible ability to identify signals, some of them disparate signals that appear disconnected to the technocrat, possibly. But in your mind, you can see these connecting and telling a different story completely. And that, I think, is a critical leadership skill as we enter this unknown future, right?
Very much so, because at the foremost, in terms of our role as leaders, we need to have the ability, as somebody once taught me, to be able to see around corners. So if you are not able, you know, to be able to pick up the signals, as you quite rightly say, and more importantly, the faint and the weak ones before they become loud, you know, and then how are you then able to lead your people? In the mining industry, for example, we tend to go through different seasons. You know, we go through very, very short summers and very, very long winters, but we have to prepare ourselves, you know, to endure, to remain going concerns and sustainable. And I found that there have been areas where it's been very, very clear that, look, what we need to do now, because we're in summer, we need to prepare for the winter. So that means we need to be more efficient. We need to be a hell of a lot more productive. And we have to make some tough decisions and some tough calls. Now, when you are printing cash, you know, prices, commodity prices are high and everything else, to try and get people to think differently is incredibly frustrating, because it's almost like, you know, what are you thinking of?
And you're almost seen as the pessimist, right? I mean, they say, well, come on, celebrate, things are going well, but you've seen ahead, you've seen around the corner.
You do, and in fact, I've been told I operated the 60,000 foot level, or I'm on another universe, and I actually need to come back down to Earth, right? On the ground, right? where the rest of us are. So those are some of the things that you have to contend with. But I think you have to build a mental toughness, you know, to be able to endure, you know, those situations, particularly, you know, when you know. And I think for me, one of the things I took up from your first podcast is that this is about as much about science as it is about art and really gut feel, right? Because, you know, you are in a different realm when you are having to think about, you know, the future and seeing and connecting the dots around how things might actually play out as opposed to relying on theory.
Yeah, you can't rely on theory all the time. And I'm curious, I mean, you've been at the highest level of governance in big corporations. What would you give our listeners as your sort of magic wand? How have you persuaded a cynical board, technocrat board, that just doesn't see what you're seeing? And how would you suggest leaders should go about moving that needle, persuading the board to see something that's not immediately obvious, because they just don't have that next dimension of thinking?
I think you have to rely on metaphors. You have to tell stories. I mean, I'll give you one example. You know, we as a business were facing a squeeze in margin, and obviously we had to do things differently as a company. And the metaphor I used was that we were this big ship, you know, and obviously being a big ship, like an oil tanker, it's always very hard to obviously turn around because it's such a big ship. We were on our way to New York, but there was this massive iceberg, right, on the way, which effectively were things like costs, some of the challenges that we have, you know, from a business perspective, you know, in terms of, you know, prices, reducing and everything else. And we effectively, you know, had to navigate, you know, around the icebergs, because if we didn't, then, you know, they would sink us just like they did with the Titanic. So using metaphors, you know, to get that understanding is very important. I also think as well that you have to do what I call signposting, where you have to take people out of the thinking realm that they're in, you know, and say, look, good people, you know, again, coming back to the metaphors, you know, we are in the woods here, right? And the thinking currently is that we are probably at the weeds. We need to elevate our thinking, you know, to the top of the canopy and to really think about how do we see the world differently from that view and perspective, as opposed to where we are. I mean, obviously, talking alone is not really good enough.
You're absolutely right, Tim, but it reminds me when you say we're at the weeds and we need to see to the top of the trees. My Latin teacher at school said, you chaps need to aim for the stars, because if you aim for the top of the trees, you're likely to hit the dirt. You know? So it kind of reminded me. But I think you've introduced such an important component, and that is, you know, metaphors and storytelling are absolutely critical. And it's not something that it's taught on MBA programs, or certainly not in the days when I did mine many decades ago. And if you think about, you know, examples of companies in the past that have failed at this, I mean, you know, the old story, and I'm embarrassed almost to raise the Kodak story, but clearly someone in Kodak never told a story about digital imagery and how it could democratize the entire industry. And the technocrats were saying, you know, protect the existing, the status quo. And we'll come back to that status quo when we talk in a few minutes about the Ptolemaic pivot. But that's the thing, you know. I don't know if you remember, Temba, you might remember the flip video camera from years ago in the sort of just 2011. That was actually developed by Cisco. And of course, I remember the flip camera very well. I owned one. It was great. It was a hugely disruptive innovation in photography and videography. But of course, Cisco just couldn't get people to believe it. You know, the brand and everything, no one wanted to believe it. And so even internally, the corporate terrorists in Cisco made sure that that innovation failed. And it was just leadership's inability to inspire through stories, I guess, you know. I want to step off in a moment the discussion around the Cassandra complex, Temba, but I'll give you a moment or two just to think of any other example or any other lesson that you would like to share with our listeners. And then from there, we'll move across to the Ptolemaic pivot.
One important thing around the Cassandra complex is that it's a very lonely space to be in when you are the dissenting view and everybody else is seeing things differently. But I mean, I always, you know, tell myself to say that a lot of the greatest inventors of the past, you know, everybody thought they were crazy and everything else. But in many ways, you know, we are benefiting from what they did, you know, to be disruptive and everything else. So whilst it might be a lonely place, you know, in the end, you know, you will be remembered for what you did. And I think that should therefore allow you, because sooner or later, people do come around, you know, but yeah, you've got that resilience, I guess.
That's classic. I'm reminded of one of the CEOs that I worked with many years ago, thinking about the future back then. He said to his leadership team, he said, ladies and gentlemen, there's no doubt that that's a really crazy idea. But the real question is it crazy enough? And I mean, he offered that. And if he's listening to the podcast, I'm sure he'll remember who he is, because I certainly do. Yeah. But he said that maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And of course, that is even more true today, because the future is even much more crazy than we could have imagined back then, you know.
Let's also not forget that there are also, you know, primeval human instincts at play here as well that we can never discount. The fact that people would want to protect the status quo because it protects their very know-how and knowledge and how they are regarded. And the fact that we tend to move as a herd. So, you know, a herd mentality. So being able to accept and appreciate that, you know, there are those, you know, primeval, you know,
survival
at the fundamental
instincts.
Level. primeval instincts, sorry, this is the wrong word. You know, those are very important elements for you as a leader to also, you know, be appreciative of.
Absolutely correct. I mean, that is so, and that's a beautiful segue, Temba, thank you, into our discussion for the next half of this podcast on the Ptolemaic pivot. And for those listeners that are confused and perhaps by my pronunciation nonetheless, it's not really an established business strategy term in the business strategy literature typically, but yet it's so important and so fascinating. And it emanates from a Greek astronomer, Claudius Ptolemy, and he advocated for a geocentric or earth-centric model of the universe. And of course, we all know that approach was subsequently replaced by the heliocentric approach or paradigm, which is really all about the universe being centered around the sun. So in a business context, from a strategy perspective, it might metaphorically describe, if you like, a shift from an outdated insular way of thinking to a much more customer-centric and outward way of looking at the marketplace. And I'm reminded, you know, of so many institutions. I mean, take the banking industry, for example, Temba. You know, they thought the universe revolved around them. And then at a deeper level of granularity, they thought the universe revolved around the mainframe computer, very often still used today and coded in a programming language that, you know, very few people will remember because it's so old. And yet the world has shifted to customer-centric, API-driven, banking as a service, etc. It's a complete pivot, right? It's a fundamental shift. But when you think you're the center of the universe, you wake up one day and discover actually your customer is the center of the universe or something else is the center of the universe and it's not you. And that's deeply problematical, right? And I guess And I'm keen to hear your views from the mining industry in particular, because that is an old industry from the days of the silting pan that we used to swish around the waters in the river to the high-tech industry that it is today. But there must have been some moments where, you know, the industry just thought they were it, if you like.
I think for me, this talks to complacency in many ways, but it also talks to the inability for us as organizations to be able to look at ourselves from an outside-in, you know, perspective in terms of, you know, how should we be looking at ourselves and where we play. And the example that I want to use is an example that relates to thermal coal. And again, it was one of the businesses that I was working for. And I think for me, the complacency was that, you know, we were a big player in the market, and we had, you know, big ambitions to basically treble our output, because our view was that, you know, there will be obviously a requirement for coal to obviously power industrialization, you know, and everything else. And it was probably at a time where, you know, aspects such as decarbonization were not, you know, really, you know, things that people were putting focus on. But there was also another phenomena which we hadn't banked on, and that was, you know, advances in fracking technology, you know, not just from, you know, fracking of the shale, but also the ability to use that gas, you know, as an alternative to oil and gas. And in particularly in the US. And in a way, though, I also blame our consultants, you know. So we were merrily...
They're always such an easy target, Tim, but come on, you can't pull that one.
No, but I mean, they had the external perspective, Anton. But you're right. But I mean, what I remember about that moment, though, was that we were full-blown expansionary mode, working out projects about how we were going to treble our capacity. And an end. Meanwhile, you know, developments were happening in the US, which were going to completely change our world and our specific part of the industry. Because when that breakthrough happened, all of a sudden, the US, you know, became less needing, you know, oil and gas from outside because of what that did, and more importantly, you know, substituted for US coal. So what do you then think happened to that US coal? It hit the international markets. All of a sudden, you know, there was a surplus, and that was a massive impact on our business. And I mean, I think for me, the lesson that I learned from that, you know, was to say, look, you have to be listening. You have to be watching, you know, because you are being disrupted, you know, even as you don't know it. And you need to make it your business to do so. You know, you cannot glow in the fact that you're the biggest, you know, and you start, you know, coming up with strategies that might actually be quite irrelevant.
It's so interesting because the ability to listen and to observe and to take in these signals and these noises and these shifts, if you like, is often precluded almost by a very simple three-letter word, which is the culprit of many corporate ill behavior, if you like. And the word is ego, right? And if you think about one of the companies, perhaps with one of the biggest corporate egos ever, led to one of the biggest financial disasters ever, nearly brought down the world financial system. And I would suggest that perhaps there was a healthy overdose of ego in that boardroom. You remember Lehman Brothers? I mean, you know, Lehman Brothers really thought they were the center of the universe. They never thought that they would collapse. They never saw it until, if you read the book, sort of 1 minute after midnight, they still didn't accept that it was all over. Because how could it happen to us? We are Lehman Brothers, right? This ego was booming this noise out to the marketplace. And of course, we all know the consequence. It reminds me, Temba, of a question that I've been asking for a long time. I wonder where the world would be today if Lehman Brothers was actually called at the time Lehman Sisters. would they have behaved as they did? And what where would we be today as a consequence?
I suppose for me, Anton, there's 2 points that come out of what you've just said there. You know, the first one is that we tend to surround ourselves with yes men and women to tell us what we want to hear. But we tend to frown on, you know, different views. So the diversity of thought, even within teams, is absolutely critical and it needs to be encouraged. And I would go beyond just internally, but having, you know, an external group advisory that is continually challenging you is really key, you know, because they also, you know, see the world differently. But also your stakeholders, right? Not just your investors, but you know, your government relations, your communities, your customers, and all that. I remember, you know, in the iron ore business, when everybody was basically building huge mines of iron ore prior to the collapse in the iron ore price, the customers were already telling us that, you know, the steel off their factory floors or the steel mills is not moving. So they don't see this thing that we are seeing. And then I think the other one for me, you know, and I take a lot of learning from the Japanese philosophies and even, you know, some of the Chinese philosophies as well. You know, for example, in you know, part of the Lean philosophy, you know, in Japanese is go see, gemba. And go see is absolutely critical. Because unless you go and see whether it's a country, whether it's a particular business, whether it's a sector, you cannot read that off the internet. You cannot read that off ChatGPT because you're only getting one lens. You're not getting the complete lens until you are in a place. So Gemba is absolutely critical for that understanding.
I want to just take us back for a moment before we start wrapping up, Themba, about your view that even at board level, you know, the responsibility is there to think more widely, to expose oneself to different thoughts and opinions and insights and signals. Again, it strikes me that if you look at governance around the world, actually, boards are structured to ensure strict governance in the sort of almost daily operations. So we have an audit committee, we have a risk committee. We have an environmental ESG committee, perhaps. Obviously, we have a remuneration committee. But I haven't yet come across too many companies in the world, even across industries, that have a committee of disruption or a committee of exponential opportunity or a committee of unthinkable futures.
Yeah.
So how do we invite and introduce and make those alternative perspectives a core part of our governance process is a real challenge, isn't it?
It is. And I think for me, Anton, you have to be deliberate. I mean, you know, I've worked for, I mean, companies. And in fact, I will name one because it also holds a dear place in my heart, Kumba. And the foresight of our chairman was that, you know, we do need to have a strategy committee as a board subcommittee. You know, which I think for me was really important because it's the place to which we were thinking about the future in terms of our business. And I think certainly, you know, we need to start to see more of that happening, you know, at board level. I think for me as well, obviously governance is absolutely critical, but we must ensure though that it mustn't just become the board just pushing governance for governance sake. Because what tends to happen then is that we become very, very mechanistic, right? And then as the old adage says, we miss the wood from the trees. So you need to get that balance right to ensure that it doesn't become a formulaic approach, you know? Because ultimately for me, you know, and this is why this mental models and these different ways of thinking is so critical, is that, you know, we want to be able to, you know, be able to handle uncertainty and everything else that's happening in relation to the future, you know, which we don't necessarily know how it's going to turn out. I also think as well that, you know, when you think about boards and executive committees, you know, and even management committees, is that you have to create the space to have these conversations. You know, this is something we certainly, you know, started adopting, you know, in my previous executive committee meetings, where, you know, because the tendency is to get straight into it, right? And then you're like, before you know it, you know, you're chasing the issue and everything else. But just taking time out to chew the fat, you know, as it were, and really having that conversation. Because, you know, that conversation is important, even if there is not necessarily clear endpoint and outcome that's required. It's that thinking space, it's that ability to think big, you know, to challenge each other's perspective. You have to create that space. And we don't do that, unfortunately. But more importantly, though, whatever we do in terms of actions and options, you know, to mitigate, have to be sustainable. And for me, it's ultimately about sustainability, such that, you know, even if, you know, the worst happens, you still continue to be a sustainable business going forward.
I want to tackle the concept of sustainability with you in more detail, but perhaps we'll leave that for a subsequent podcast, because we're running out of valuable airtime here. But I just wanted to make two comments before we wrap up, Themba. The one is that you know, in terms of both the Cassandra complex and the Ptolemaic pivot, it just struck me as we were discussing this now that the role of the whistleblower in corporate life and in government life, if you like, is so important. And very often it's the whistleblowers that see the problems and that no one wants to believe them. I mean, that's a real example of Cassandra complex. But I think it's such an important thing that we need to pay attention to. But in the corporate sense, on a more positive note, you know, it's the voice of the young people. I'll never forget doing a strategy process for an international investment bank. And with the executive team at the end of this five-month project, the CEO said, "Anton, that was an exceptional experience. Thank you so much. But you made a fundamental error." And I started perspiring and I went white in the face. And I thought, wow, you know, what did I miss? And he said, "There's no one in this room or part of this process that's under the age of 47. And he said, "The people that will implement and benefit from our strategy today are the 30-year-olds. And he then said, "Please repeat the process with the 30-year-old investment bankers and see how their view diverges or not from our view." And that was an incredible insight. But one needs to institutionalize the openness with which you engage other voices across the organization. So important. So, folks, there we are at the end of today's podcast, our more granular deep dive into the Cassandra complex and the Ptolemaic pivot. So much more that could be said. Themba, I know I've barely scratched the surface of your deep wisdom, your artistic flair and talents, your ability to see around the corners. But I want to thank you so much for your time today. It's been a real privilege to have you on this podcast, and I'm sure our listeners will take pearls of wisdom away with them. Folks, that brings us to the end. We will, in the next few weeks, we will be recording our third episode in this podcast series of Fast Forward, powered by Future World, where we will investigate in more detail, give you classical examples, bring leaders of Themba's stature to this conversation as we explore the lighthouse keeper's dilemma, the boiling frog syndrome, and interestingly, Darwin Finch's theory from the Galapagos Islands. Thank you so much for your time listening to us today. We look forward to engaging you again. Watch the space, folks. There are exciting things coming your way in this incredible Fast Forward series by Future World. Themba, thank you, sir. Travel safely, and I look forward to seeing you again in person.
Thank you. Thank you, Anton. I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you.